Let me ask you, who would you want by your side when the zombie apocalypse hits? If you answered that your ideal survival team included three scouts, a strip club cocktail waitress, and a whole lot of teen hormones and anxiety, then you've probably watched one too many movies. Luckily for you, the movie in question is The Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse. And let me tell you, it's not that bad. Welcome, welcome, one and all to It's Not That Bad, the podcast that looks for A grades in B movies. Now, I am always really excited when it comes to a movie that I have never before seen. We've covered a bunch that I've seen before, and then we've covered a bunch of films that I had forgotten I'd seen. Then you come across a scene and you go, oh, that movie. This was a film I had never watched until preparing for this episode. And to thank for that movie, the one and only Peter from the Movie Duel Podcast. Pete, welcome back to the show. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing really well. Thank you, Jason. Thanks for having me back. I'm looking forward to getting my It's Not That Bad badge today.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Now, I had never seen this film. I'd heard of this film. I was curious about the title, but then it's one of those movies that just kind of, oh, the movie sounds like it'd be fun, and then I just never watched it. Obviously, you've seen it before because you're the one who pitched this film. What is it about The Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse that made you want to discuss this film today?
Well, I think it was very much of the same opinion as you that, you know, it looked a bit fun, but I kind of had my fill of sort of zombie comedy films by the mid-noughties for sure. And it just sort of popped up. I think it was on Amazon Prime, something like that. And I just thought, you know, I'll give it a go, see what it's like. And I just remember having a whole lot of fun with it. I'd only seen it the once. And to be completely honest, when I pitched it to you and you said, let's go for it, I was actually a little bit nervous because I couldn't remember a whole lot about it. But, you know, this was my second viewing and I just absolutely loved it. Probably even more than my first viewing. Just, you know, lots of gore, adolescent humor. Nods to some, you know, great horror classics, and it's got zombie cats,
right? Oh, there's so much in this film. And if I'm being very honest, so growing up, there was a video store near my place called Video Blocks. It's no longer there anymore, much like every other video rental store. Mm-hmm. And I remember my buddy and I going to this place and renting movies literally based on the title alone. So that's how movies like Surf Nazis Must Die entered my lexicon. You know, classics like Bloodsucking Pharaohs in Pittsburgh, the ever wonderful film Stuff Stephanie in the Incinerator. By the way, if you can't tell the sarcasm by this point, there's a lot of sarcasm at this point here. But this kind of falls into one of those movies that catches you by the title alone. So I'm going to ask you before we get into this, based on movies that you have seen, is there a movie out there with a title that is beyond this one that you remember renting it literally or at least watching it based on the title alone?
God, you really are putting me on the spot there. I think actually Sharktopus.
Oh my God.
I don't remember ever renting it. I think I watched it on streaming, but that was... You know, and that had come after, you know, Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus and all those sort of asylum films. And I just thought, Sharktopus, this has got to be either so bad it's reasonably entertaining or it's just funny as hell. And it was quite, you know, of the films of those ilk, Sharktopus is probably one of the better ones.
You know what? I'm glad you mentioned films like Sharktopus and Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus, which of course was episode one of this podcast, was Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus. But I'm going to drop a little bit of breaking news here before we get to the trailer eyes. You're actually the first person to hear this. So to you, our listeners, and to Peter as well, I want to invite you back to this podcast this October, because this October, we're going to be celebrating the only way this damn podcast knows how, Mocktober. That's right. We are going to spend a month looking at nothing but mockbusters. So asylum films, get ready. We're coming for you. But before we get to Mocktober and before we get to this film, it is time to take this zombie comedy, this zomcom, if you will, and trailerize it.
Scouting law dictates that a scout is helpful and trustworthy, kind and cheerful, considerate and clean, and wise in the use of all resources. Now, meet Ben, Carter, and Augie, three scouts who embody some of that. Along the way, they'll meet Denise, the cleanest girl in a dirty establishment, who's considerate enough to help to get them to safety before the town gets bombed. But before that, the boys will go back into the danger zone like all good idiotic horror movie characters to save Carter's sister so Ben can do his best to smash that crush. Along the way, they'll grab more than they bargained for and stretch their luck in a film that definitely wasn't adapted from the Scouting Handbook. The Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse. Rated R. For Rogers, Undead Scout Leader Supreme.
Excellent.
I think I should actually put a disclaimer on this episode and let everyone know that, yes, I too was also in scouting. So I was ready for this film. I was prepared for this film.
Excellent. It's never something I got into as a kid. I had a few friends who were in the scouts and stuff, but it just didn't tickle my fancy.
Yeah. See, when you mentioned this film, I was like, I'm going to get a bigger laugh out of this because I spent many years in scouting. So again, I was ready for this one.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
But let's talk about who's in this film. The movie stars Ty Sheridan, Logan Miller, Joey Morgan, Sarah Dumont, Halston Stage, David Koechner, and Cloris Leachman. And again, if I messed up any of those names, you guys have met me. The movie was directed by Christopher Landon, who also directed Happy Death Day, the sequel to that, and Freaky. However, this film has an almost title to it, something that we don't get the chance to do very often, but when we do, we jump on it. Because this film was almost titled Scouts versus Zombies. I kind of like the fact that it's a longer title. I like the Scouts Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse. But I mean, if you told me that there was a film called Scouts versus Zombies, I'd still be kind of into this.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that versus was very overused around this time as well. And you had a lot of cheaper films, you know, especially, there was zombies, werewolves versus strippers, pro wrestlers versus zombies, all sorts of different films. And, you know, they were very cheap films. They were very, very much C movies or Z movies or however far you want to go down the list. And, you know, I think that sort of title was really cheapening of a film at that time.
I also think, and bear with me here, because I'm probably going to jump a little bit ahead of my notes. There are points in this movie where it feels like a lot of inspiration was pulled from certain video games like Dead Rising and Left 4 Dead. So if you have a game or a movie title like Scouts vs. Zombies, the first thought that came to my mind when I read that was Plants vs. Zombies, the video game. So I wonder if that was specifically to distance itself from those kind of comparisons.
Yeah, quite possibly. Yeah.
This movie was actually on the 2010 blacklist for most liked unmade scripts of the year. So you damn well knew that this film was going to get made. And it did pretty well. At the 2016 Golden Trailer Awards, it was nominated for Best Viral Campaign, but lost to Paranormal Activity, The Ghost Dimension. It was also nominated for Most Innovative Advertising for a Feature Film, but lost to Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. And at the 2016 iHorror Awards, Sarah Dumont was nominated for Best Female Performance in a Horror Movie. She lost to Juliana Harkavy for Last Shift. And Ty Sheridan was nominated for Best Male Performance in a Horror Movie. He lost to Mark Duplass for Creep. Unfortunately, the box office wasn't too kind to them. This film, while only having a budget of $15 million, domestically only made $3.7 million and worldwide $16 million. When it debuted on the October 13th, 2015 weekend, and perfect, debut on Halloween weekend, you're going to do good, right? Wrong. This film debuted with only $1.8 million, debuting at number 12. It was the lowest grossing wide release debut that week. Also debuting that weekend was Burnt, debuted at number 6 with $5 million. And Our Brand is Crisis, which debuted at number 8 with $3.2 million. The top grossing film with only $11.7 million was the fifth week of The Martian. That's topping out also Goosebumps at number 2, Bridge of Spies number 3, Hotel Transylvania at number 2, and The Last Witch Hunter at number 5. So even a zombie film on Halloween weekend is not necessarily box office gold. But the reason why we are here, not just because Peter has awesome taste in films, is the critics. Over at Metacritic, this film has a Metascore of 32. And over at Rotten Tomatoes, the audience score is right down the middle at 50%. And the Tomatometer is only 44%. So I will say I'm surprised that the Metacritic score is lower than both the audience score and the Tomatometer on Rotten Tomatoes. And I recognize, dear listeners, that using one metric over the other is not exactly a fair assumption, or at least a proper way to gauge films, but we are here to tell you the critics are wrong anyway, so we're going to do what we want. But taking a look at this, 44% for a pretty damn funny zom comedy, that seems remarkably low.
Yeah, absolutely. I know perhaps the kind of adolescent humor that is in this film maybe doesn't resonate with a modern younger audience, I suppose. I think that's maybe where it struggles a little bit, or it will struggle with certain people, not with me. You know, I grew up with, you know, American Pies and those kind of films, you know, so the humor is not something that's, you know, offensive to me, I suppose, but you know, it's good childish humor, and maybe this film is a little bit too much of a horror, I suppose. So I think it's very gory. You know, even films like well thought of comedies, zombie comedies like Shaun of the Dead, although they're quite violent, they're a lot more straightforward, I guess, but this is very sort of brutal horror gore compared to that, I suppose. I think it probably doesn't strike the right tone with a lot of people, or with an average audience, I suppose.
See, it's funny, you are talking about the film being maybe a little bit over the top kind of thing, and on a gore perspective, I can absolutely agree, because there are some of the bloodbaths, if you will, in this are pretty out there and pretty grotesque. And yeah. The thing is, I'm kind of fine with that, because the rest of it is, I find, a little bit more grounded in reality. For as much as you can put a raunchy zombie comedy film in there, but let's get into that. Let's start with Ty Sheridan, who of course plays Ben, the main guy of the trio of scouts. How was Ty Sheridan for you?
I think he's really great in this. I've not seen him in a great deal other than as Cyclops in the X-Men prequels, I guess they are, or side shifts of the universe. But I thought he does really well to sort of carry it. You know, he's got quite a complex character. You know, he's the in-betweener of the group. He's not, you know, about the party life and all that sort of stuff. He's still got one foot in the scouts and one foot in, you know, getting older and becoming, you know, a ladies' man or trying to. And it's quite an endearing performance, I think. You know, he's quite complex. You know, he's got this crush on Carter's sister, and he's the one who starts to build this friendship with Denise, who's obviously a stripper, and you know,
cocktail waitress.
Sorry, yes, she works at the strip bar. Do apologize. But yeah, I think he, you know, in the performance, he hits the comedic notes as really, really well as well. His squealing is top notch. It's Fay Wray quality. I really enjoyed him in this film.
I think you nailed it right on the head. Is that for a film that includes zombie boobs, zombie dick, and a whole lot of blood being poured out of a bottle stuck in someone's head, Ben is actually a pretty damn wholesome character, and he's very relatable. I remember when we were covering the movie Game Over Man, which is a Netflix exclusive, like original film. And the three main characters in that were all pretty much varying levels of idiotic. Here, you actually have three characters that A, make sense together as, you know, childhood teenage friends, and B, they're not idiots. They're not just there for the gags. The insanity happens around them. Ben is actually a pretty decent character as far as being like a typical, you know, well-raised teen.
Yeah. And I think the characters Carter and Ogie are, they're probably a little bit more stereotypical for this kind of film, you know, like a Goonies style Monster Squad, Stand By Me kind of, you know, coming of age story. They're a little bit more stereotypical, whereas the Ben character it's got a lot more to it. It's got a lot more facets to that character. He's not just a geek who is, you know, slightly charming to girls or anything like that. He's wanting to explore, being with girls and, you know, his sexuality and all that sort of stuff. And it's just, really great, complex character.
Yeah, there is a little bit of that Sean Astin in Goonies kind of portrayal in this. But the other thing, too, with Ben is that he's the guy stuck in the middle of this trio. Yeah. Because you got Carter, who wants to grow up and be cool and be accepted. Then you've got Augie, who is quite comfortable in his safe place. His almost comfortable level of safety and not willing to really jump out of that just yet. There's a lot to Augie. We're going to get to Augie in a bit, but Ben is in that middle because he wants to maintain his friendship with Augie. He knows that if they leave scouting, it's going to affect it, but he also doesn't want to be left behind by Carter. Ben's in a really difficult position, and I think that adds a little bit to the wholesomeness of it, because all of his motivation in this is based on trying to keep his little Three Musketeers friendship thing together.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Logan Miller, who played Carter. So here's the crazier one of the three of them. How much fun was he?
Oh, so much, so much. I mean, this, you know, he's probably quite relatable as, you know, I think that all these characters are quite relatable, especially to someone like me, because I probably am a mix of all three of these characters, you know, maybe not to the degree that Carter is in this film, certainly not, but, you know, we're all young, horny teenagers at some point, and, you know, you get a bit sort of down that rabbit hole of being a bit sex obsessed and girl obsessed, and, you know, and like he says in the film, he just wanted to see some titties, you know. that's part of growing up, and that's part of being a teenager, and especially being a male teenager. But yeah, it's just, he is so much fun. He's very, again, you know, he hits the comedic beats really well. You know, it's although it is quite a stereotypical character, it still has a lot of heart towards the end, and he's still, you know, got certain facets to his character, and Logan Miller plays it really well. You know, he's not just a complete, he's not a Steve Stifler. He's not, you know, he's not completely brash and horrible to the degree of something like a Steve Stifler. He's still got an ounce of charm to him.
I'm glad you pointed out the Stifler thing, because he does have a little bit of that, you know, a bit of the wilder side to him. But I think at the core of it too, Carter is very much he's not confident at this point. Mm-hmm. He sees everyone else who is out there and getting girlfriends and going to parties and being accepted. And, you know, he's still within his scouting trio. And, you know, these are the friends that he grew up with and whatnot. And there's a comfort level in that, but there also needs to be growth. I mean, with growth becomes more world experience. I can almost look at Carter as like a combination between Stifler and Eddie K. Thomas, who played Finch, who, of course, banged Stifler's mom in American Pie. You know, but you take those two, you put those two, together, and that character almost feels like Carter.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, he's definitely got those facets of being sex obsessed and sort of being a bit sort of, like you said, he's not got the confidence of a Steve Stifler. He's definitely a bit more unsure of how to get to that position of a Steve Stifler, I suppose.
Yeah, and it really hits him hard too when he realizes they were given the wrong address for for the secret senior party kind of thing. So you can see the vulnerability too. Like, that's where that character really becomes a much more complete character. Like, he's no longer just, you know, Jokey McJokerson, you know, horn dog teenager. You know, this is a guy who wants more, wants to do more, wants to be more than he feels that he is, regardless of realizing that really his life has gotten him to a point where he has a solid circle of friends that will always be there if he allows them to be there. It's kind of not seeing the forest from the trees for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he saw the boobs, and that was all that mattered.
That's one of the scenes that just stuck with me. The officer Hottie getting stuck on the chain link fence. And just, he couldn't resist. He just could not resist of having a feel.
But you know what's funny? You have to have those moments in those films where there's a lot going on. There's a lot of action. There's a lot of blood, you know, blood and guts and gore and all that. You have to have a moment for just those guffaws. Like, just the, I can't believe we're doing a slow-mo reaction to him seeing zombie boobs.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, you know, It's you get quite a fleeting sort of appearance of this. I believe it's Missy Martinez who plays Officer Hottie. You get quite a fleeting sort of glimpse of her early in the film, and it does feel a little bit like a point I come to a bit later, that it feels like a lot was cut from this film, maybe for time, because you get a fleeting sort of glimpse of her and they mention it, and then obviously she sort of turns up at the chain link fence, but. It's just a very funny moment and very over the top. And the fact that he runs away saying, "I think they were fake," or "they didn't feel real," or something like that.
I wonder, and you know, in my research for this, I didn't see anything about any cut downs kind of thing, but you're right. I think there is a point where you could sit there and say, this feels like there was probably a bit more and they probably scaled it back. I wonder if what they scaled back was probably a lot more blood, more guts, and a bit further into the crassness. I wonder if there's an unrated version out there that's just dying to be released.
Quite possibly. I mean, I think by this time, mid 2010s, we were away from that sort of you know, in the 2000s, it was, everything was unrated when it was released on DVD or the uncut versions and things like that. But we didn't seem to get that as much in the 2010s. So maybe not. I don't know. I think, you know, the runtime is a very big plus for this film. I think it's, you know, hour and a half. It's a lovely svelte runtime for this kind of film.
Yeah, and that's the thing too, is that if you're going, we saw this a lot too, especially with movies in like the early noughts and whatnot, where, you know, the movie comes out and it's either a really risque PG-13 or a very watered down rated R, and then all of a sudden the DVD comes out and it's like, oh, and by the by, here's what got cut. I'm so curious if there is more to that.
Possibly. There may be, you know, they may be, you know, I mean, you could put down to, I don't really know about the marketing for this film. Is it a case of, you know, they didn't really know how to market it, because it is, you know, on paper, and you could read about, you know, if you read the synopsis, then it, you know, it could very easily be a PG-13. But, you know, the film is very gory. There's a huge amount of sex references, and there are obviously a lot of body parts on show as well. So maybe, you know, maybe the studio found it difficult to market. They cut it down to size, just to maybe try and get something a little bit lower than an R. You know, I mean, it was probably a 15 over here, I think, which is probably close to your R rating over that side.
Joey Morgan, who played Augie, if you remember back to when we did the Monster Squad episode, on that episode, I mentioned that Horace was kind of like a much better version of Chunk from the Goonies. So we're going to build on that one now. Personal opinion, I think Augie is better than Horace, who is better than Chunk. It's almost like Augie is the much more emotionally developed kind of version of that character. But how was Joey Morgan for you?
I think you're absolutely right. I totally agree with that. I think he, you know, he knows what it is. He loves being in the Scouts, and he doesn't care. You know, he's not a Horace or a Chunk who, you know, comes off as slightly embarrassed as being, you know, maybe the fat kid in the group, let's say. You know, he just loves his life. He loves doing what he's doing with the Scouts. You know, obviously you get these smatterings of a backstory where his dad's maybe, you know, died or gone away. And he really is the heart of the film, because he is what pulls this group of friends together in the end. And the whole sort of crux to get to the end of the film, not just to save the sister, you know, is about almost making amends with the Augie character as well. And it just has so many great moments in this film, particularly mimicking, getting the zombie to mimic Baby One More Time by Britney Spears, which I totally forgot from the first time watching. And this time around, I was howling at that.
We're going to get to that scene a little bit later, because I have thoughts about that scene, and they're fascinating thoughts. And it's probably going to lead us into some really, really weird conversation, but we're going to get back to that in a second here. But I think the thing with Augie too is that you had the ability to make this a one note joke character, you know, the fat kid who's way into scouting and everything is about it. But no, the way he's written is that it's almost like he's taken scouting and his friends as a way of coping with the trauma of his dad passing away. And it's not like he's spouting scout law every step he gets kind of thing. He's a very realistic kid who's found his vibe. He's confident enough in that vibe and comfortable with everyone in that vibe. Augie is a very self-strong character, and I find it funny that both Ben and Carter find like they're having to tiptoe around him, when Augie seems to be the kind of character that would understand if they just approached him a lot more honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think he is probably the most sort of mature of the group, really. I think it's interesting that the three characters, you've got these sort of levels to them, is that, you know, Carter wants to grow up too quickly. you know, Ben's in the middle, he's sitting on the fence. He's very much, you know, he wants to do some stuff, but he wants to sort of stick to his roots. And then you've got Augie, who's just happy and content with, you know, growing up gracefully, I suppose.
Yeah, Augie is, you're right, he is the much more mature of the three. He's the much more self-aware of the three, I think. And that's a wonderful thing to see in that character. And that's the thing, too. These three main characters are not just goofballs. They're not idiots. And they don't do dumb things aside from run back into the city. But that's just horror movie trope right there. But, you know, when you take a look at these three characters, they are smart, self-aware, and confident enough to be able to use the resources around them to survive the zombie apocalypse. And the crazy happens around them, which is a lot more different from a lot of movies that would probably attack this kind of scenario where the three would be idiots and somehow survive the zombie apocalypse. Here you have three very confident scouts surviving the zombie apocalypse, also with the help of Sarah Dumont, who plays Denise Russo. How was she for you?
I thought quite a good female representation, really. You know, again, this kind of film could sort of whiff this kind of character quite easily. But she's very, you know, headstrong. She's portrayed as a really good female character, I think. And Sarah Dumont plays her really well. It's not over the top. She's, you know, she's scared when she needs to be scared. She's confident when she needs to be confident. And it's quite a good range for that character. I think quite sensibly, you know, she disappears for a good chunk of the film. I think if she had have been in that sort of middle third, I suppose, her character would have maybe lost something. So I think the script is very clever in sort of writing her out at a certain point. And yeah, I just thought it was, you know, she comes in as this sort of, you know, a very strong character who sort of grounds them a little bit and keeps them from maybe making stupid decisions, I suppose. But yeah, I thought a really good representation, really good character, and a really good performance from her as well.
You could have run the risk with this character of having her as one of the strippers and really kind of, for lack of a better term, trashing the character out, right? Yeah. Have her become the sex symbol, or at least the girl to pursue for Carter, because there was always that potential for that to happen. But yeah, I think the fact that Denise comes in wielding a shotgun, she's not a stripper, she's the cocktail waitress, you know, she's confident enough in how to at least use firearms to get them past the, for lack of a better term, the first level of the video game. And I think the fact that when Denise and Carter first really interact with each other, aside from buying beer, it's after Carter has been covered in zombie blood that, you know, came out of the bottle top that he stuck in the zombie's head. Clearly sex is not on his mind at the time, but for someone who's, you know, constantly thinking about, I want to see boobs, I want to see boobs, he never does that to Denise. And I think there's something smart in that writing.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, even if they had, you know, there's that clever sort of twist that she isn't a stripper and she's the cocktail waitress and things. But I think the portrayal that Sarah Dumont puts across, you could still have had her as a stripper as well. And I think it would still have worked, because, you know, just because somebody's a stripper doesn't mean that they're not capable of, you know, handling themselves or being smart or anything else like that. And I think, you know, even if they're not throwing that curveball in, say curveball, not really that, but had they not thrown that facet of the character in, then it would still have worked, because I think she's a very capable actress and capable of pulling that off, whatever.
There's a moment in this film where they're in the sister's room trying to find the diary so they can go in and save Carter's sister, who of course is the girl that Ben has been pining over. And then Denise basically gets Ben to kiss her so he can feel confident about kissing the sister, kind of thing. How did that scene play out for you? I have thoughts on that scene, but how was that scene for you?
I thought it worked really well. You know, I mean, I'm not prude, and I'm not, you know, and I think, you know, just because, you know, somebody kisses somebody doesn't mean that they're in love or in lust or anything else. And, you know, it's perfectly fine for a character to, you know, instill confidence in somebody by giving something away to them, with, you know, in this case, a kiss. And she's, you know, she's doing it for, it doesn't cheapen the character. She, you know, she's not doing it. She's not getting off on it. She's not doing it to try and seduce him or anything like that. She's like, you know, you need to get a grip. This is how you do it. It's nothing, but you can make it special, kind of thing.
Yeah. I think it was important that when Ben first goes in for the kiss, he straight up headbutts her. I think that scene was meant more to, you know, put a much more wholesome spin on Ben, because clearly he ain't done this before, and it becomes very much like a mentor moment. Like, you can do this, kiddo. You can do this. And it, you're right, didn't come off as creepy. It didn't come off as salacious. And it didn't take away from the strength that Denise had built up for the first half of the film.
Yeah, exactly. It'd be easy to just, you know, write that character off as being trashy and just, it doesn't. It hold, you know, that the script and the way it works and the performances keep it at a level where you go, you know, she's doing something because she knows this guy needs a bit of help.
Yeah, in the most traumatic of times. And the other thing too is, you have to think that Denise is obviously older than the other three because she's already left high school and whatnot. So it would be weird if it became something where Carter was constantly chasing after her and then, you know, that they got together at the end. No, she's going to go do her own thing and live her own life and still keep in contact, because I guess when you survive a zombie apocalypse, you become friends for life, which I'm kind of okay with that. David Koechner, though, did not survive this. Scout Leader Rogers, how much fun was he?
Oh, so much fun, so much fun. I mean, I've only ever seen him in sort of a few sort of fleeting roles where he's playing somebody who's sort of brash and cocky and quite arrogant. And, you know, it was nice to see him playing quite a wholesome character. It was something that I'd not sort of seen before. But, yeah, you know, and he has, you know, he has some really sweet, inspiring lines at the start. You know, people, some people just never achieve anything in their lives, and you know, the moments where he's getting a bit creeped out in the woods, and he says an A wipe and a C word, and that's the actual quote from the film, which is just so funny, so charming, for that kind of character. He plays it, you know, he plays it really well. It's written really well, and his performance as a zombie is really good as well. And really, you know, it's one of the best zombie performances in history, I would say.
I think, and it's funny you mentioned him in more serious films. Anytime I see him, the first films that come to mind, of course, are like Anchorman, and when he played Cooter in Dukes of Hazzard, which of course we've talked about on this episode before, and Waiting, which we've talked about on this show before. So, you know, he's also got a very good comedy background to him. I think the thing I like about this, and aside from the fact that, yes, he does have some very good one-liners before and after he dies, is that he's not used as a cautionary tale for the other scouts as to, if you stay in scouting too long, this is what you're going to become, right? That could have happened, but it didn't. Instead, he's more like the running gag. You know, it's the, what do you have to do to kill Scout Leader Rogers for real, right? And yet, I mean, that's the thing. Zombies can absorb, I guess, a lot of damage unless you finally get them in the head. So the fact that, you know, he's still kicking near the end of the film and beyond, that's all I'm going to say. You have to watch the whole damn film, credits included, people. I love the fact that this is a running gag and it becomes funnier every time he shows up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and that's always the mark of a good comedy, a running gag. And he is the most, you know, he is that consistent gag through the whole film. And appear, you know, right until the end. He's the last sort of zombie that we see. And yeah, it just takes a battering, absolute battering, which is always great to see in this kind of film.
I love the fact that at that point, when they encounter him again for the last time, and at this point, he's taken so much damage that he's moving a lot slower than he was before. So they're actually like, they have time to start looking around. It's like, oh, come on. Does anyone got a weapon? Can we hit him with something? And they're just literally like very nonchalantly looking around. Like, we've killed so many zombies at this point. Why don't you just die? And that's, yeah. There's just something funny in the plainness of that moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
A couple of smaller roles here for us to discuss before we get to the film as a whole. Halston Sage, who played Kendall Grant. Again, this is Carter's sister, who Ben, of course, has had a crush on the entire time. How was she for you?
I think, you know, it's a very straightforward role, this one. You know, she's there to be a bit of, you know, the object of somebody's affection. She doesn't get a whole heap of chance to develop a character very well, other than, you know, she's the sort of probably popular girl who has the arsehole boyfriend. And then, you know, that's who, you know, I mean, she is the anchor point for the last act of the film. They're all going to save her at this party. But she, you know, she doesn't get a great deal to do. So I wouldn't say it's a brilliant performance, but I wouldn't say it's a bad performance either.
First things first, they picked an actress who has a very, for lack of a better term, a very wholesome look. Like, I think she fit the role of Kendall very well.
Yeah.
When they came upon the scouts after they had hit the deer with the car, there's this moment where she's talking to Ben and, you know, she's basically checking on them to see if they're okay and all that. And at no point is she making fun of their thing in scouting. No. You know, she's known him for a long time. And there's a moment where I can't remember what the conversation was about, but they kind of pause and they're just kind of staring at each other. And it's a very wholesome moment. It's a very sweet moment. And I think that's really all the clue you need to think that Kendall maybe also likes Ben, but at no point is it this, you know, oh, I've always liked you kind of thing. No, yeah. It's very subtle. If you look for it, you can see it. And the fact that she is mad at her boyfriend for giving her brother the wrong direction clearly shows that she's also a decent person as well. So it makes sense that Ben has a thing for Kendall. But I got a beef here. I got a beef, and it has nothing to do with Halston Sage or the character of Kendall.
Okay.
I'm fine with Ben having a crush on Kendall. I get that. That's fine. Mm-hmm. There was a picture of her in his compass. And if Augie knew that Ben had a thing for Kendall and they'd been in scouts for so long, how long has that picture been in the compass? And how did Carter not see that it was a picture of his sister in Ben's compass? How is Carter so oblivious to seeing the fact that Ben's got the hots for sister?
I guess so, but then he must have his own compass, so, you know, you maybe not looking at other people's compasses.
Not a moral not compass a of that, either. So. But I do agree that I think they picked the right actress to play Kendall Grant, and I think they gave Kendall enough moments to show that she's kind of almost worthy of Ben at this point, because they've really painted Ben to be a pretty wholesome kid.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
And finally, Cloris Leachman, who played Miss Fielder. I am always a fan of amazing, long-tenured actresses and actors who take the latter parts of their career and just really have fun with it. And she's having fun with this. How was Miss Fielder for you?
Yes, Miss Fielder. Crazy cat lady.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, for any boy of this age, crazy old lady, creepy old lady, aggressive old lady is always something that's quite freaky. And she just, yeah, has a whole, you know, like you said, a whole heap of fun with this role and really nails it. And, you know, she's obviously has a whole lot of fun being zombie version of Miss Felder as well. And again, you know, comes up, it gives us one of the most amazing scenes in this film where her false teeth come out and she bites Carter on the ass.
Thank God that the false teeth came out at that point.
Which, but yeah, she's just, yeah, really, she really pulled it off really well. And full kudos to her. She goes right into the role. Yeah.
I was going to say, how do you read the script and go, false teeth fall out, you start biting his ass, but because there's no teeth in your mouth, it does, you're basically gumming his bum. And...
yeah.
Which some people pay money for that, but you know. Oh, we have devolved the show already here. But we're talking about the Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse, so I guess there was nowhere to go but down. The zombies in this film, because as I'm watching this, you know, obviously it feels like there's two types of zombies, right? There's your classic Night of the Living Dead, clearly brain dead, working on autopilot, kind of slow, feet dragging kind of zombie. And then, of course, you have the complete opposite end of the spectrum in World War Z, where they are almost like hyped up, souped up, steroided up, and swarming type zombies. These zombies kind of fit more on the World War Z side, just, you know, scaled down quite a bit, but they're a lot faster. They are a lot more deadly and a lot more dangerous until you get to Scout Leader Rogers at the very end. Mm-hmm. But did you find that the more dangerous version of zombies in this added a little bit more to it?
Well, I think what it does quite cleverly actually is that there's a bit of inconsistency to them, because not, you know, for the vast majority, there are, you know, the speedy zombies, the fast zombies. But they're also, you know, the right moments, there are some that maybe aren't, you know, whether they've got injured legs or damage done to them. And they fit though the different kind of zombies into the different kind of scenes, which works really well, I thought. You know, I'm a bit of a zombie purist, so I like the George A. Romero slow plodding zombies. But I'm not, you know, I'm not against the 28 Days Later, Zack Snyder kind of, you know, superstar running zombies. I think you make the zombies work for the story that you're telling, and this does it in multiple different ways, I think, which is really great.
Yeah, because this is more, you know, if you take a look at a movie like Shaun of the Dead, you know,
yeah,
and they're literally like, you know, they have enough time to be able to figure out which vinyl they're going to throw at the zombie because the zombie is, you know, slow and lumbering and just very, very, you know, down to one.
Yeah.
I think in a movie like this, which has a bit more action and a bit more intensity to it.
Yeah.
You need to have a bit more of a more formidable zombie to deal with. Because if you got time to think about it, you take out the, you know, the intensity of what they're building up here.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
You mentioned the Britney Spears scene where they get one of the zombies to all of a sudden start remembering the fact that he's a Britney Spears fan, because of course he's wearing a Britney Spears t-shirt, and busts down to almost like a dance off for Hit Me Baby One More Time. But I wonder, and I obviously we don't know, because zombies don't really exist in our world, and thank God they don't. But I found it interesting that you had some of the zombies in this film almost like they were stuck in the mindset of the moment that they were in upon death.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, clearly the guy who made this film is a big horror fan. You know, there are a lot of callbacks in this film, not just to zombie films, but Halloween. It has very Return of the Living Dead vibes, Reanimator. There are a lot of nods to classic horror. And, you know, this, that sort of facet of it is very George A. Romero. Dawn of the Dead, absolutely classic film, the original one. And it talks about, why are these zombies coming to the mall? Because that's what they're used to. And they're just remembering the, you know, the everyday. So they come in and trying to walk around the mall because that's what they did in life. And this guy obviously danced and sang to Britney Spears.
It also explains, too, how Scout Leader Rogers made it from the woods after being killed back to his home. It's almost like there's, you know, there are core memories that, you know, there's still a little bit of electrical activity in the brain. So, I mean, there are movies that have, I mean, Lisa Frankenstein, which is in theaters right now, where, you know, the fact that, you know, he's starting to feel a bit more again, thanks to, you know, Lisa, herself, like there's more to it. So obviously you can have different versions of zombie films.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you, you mentioned that you are a zombie purist.
Yeah.
So where does this movie sit in the pantheon of zombie films?
I think it is actually, I'm going to go out on a limb and say it is a great modern zombie film because it tells a heartwarming story around the zombie experience or the zombie apocalypse. Now, in the same way that Shaun of the Dead did, you know, it was a very knowing film, and it was very respectful of everything that came before it and what the filmmakers obviously have a passion for. And I think that comes across again in this film. And you know, for somebody who is a horror fan and can see those beats, it's very respectful of them. And it's maybe doesn't do it, you know, it's not 100% original. The Scout, you know, part of the story is the original part of the story. And I think it works really well as a zombie comedy or a zomcom or whatever you want to call it. Because it is genuinely funny and it's gory and it, you know, it'll those parts of it that will satisfy horror lovers and not just people who are wanting to have a laugh.
All right. So now it's come time, Peter. Who is your MVP of Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse?
This was so tough. This was really tough. And I'm still quite undecided, even at this point. But I think it is Joey Morgan.
I could see that. Orky.
Because I think it is, you know, the whole, it has this really sweet, almost Toy Story 3 kind of ending where they're all down to, you know, they're going to have to sacrifice themselves or they're just going to accept their fate, go down as a group. And they all, you know, everything goes full circle and they all, you know, pour out their hearts to each other and apologize and everything else. And he's that central part of that story. And I think he just connects the whole of the film. As good as Ty Sheridan is, I think without that really good portrayal of Oggy, then the Ty Sheridan character wouldn't be as good.
Before I drop my MVP, I'm going to ask you, because you know nothing in Hollywood is untouched. Mm-hmm. If it worked well, I think as a zombie film, it does work well. Even if the box office didn't justify it, the fact that there are no bad movie award nominations for this film. There are actually some decent, you know, nominations on the horror side of things. Is there room for a Scout's Guide 2, or is this one of those films where you want it just left on its own?
Yeah, I would hope not, because I think that the story does go full circle. And I think the only way you're going to make a sequel is if you're completely rehashing stuff from the first film. You know, you could have more a bigger scout group, but that's just going to dilute the heart of the film completely. I don't think it would work without just being the same.
All right. You mentioned Ty Sheridan when you were, you know, tossing up your MVPs. He's actually my MVP. He's the moral center of the film. He's the center point of the main three. And I think this film doesn't work if he isn't as likable as he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I get that. Yeah, definitely.
All right, Pete, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to finally knock this film off my bucket list. Before we go, please remind our viewers about the Movie Duel podcast and where they can find you out there on the interwebs.
Okay, so you can find the Movie Duel podcast at all good platforms for podcasts. Just give us a search. We're on Facebook, we're on X, we're on Threads, Instagram, all those places we can find out what we've got coming up on the podcast. We also have our special guest episodes called Quick Draw, and one of which is featuring Jason himself, which is very good. Go and have a listen. And I am also now on the a brand new project that myself, one of my Movie Duel co-hosts, Vanessa, have started, an X-Files podcast called So-Called X-Files, in which we dip into some of our favourite episodes season by season. So you can find that at all good podcast stations as well. And we've just started a Patreon page for the Movie Duel podcast, so check that out.
And that kind of feels like your X-Files connection of this episode.
Yes, indeed.
By all means, but be sure to follow the Movie Duel podcast, follow the new project, make sure you give them those 5-star ratings on all of your podcatcher apps. And to you, our listeners, thank you. Now, you guys know the drill. If there's a movie out there that you think is unfairly maligned, or there is no way in the zombie apocalypse that we can find anything good to say about it, hit us up on social media at NotThatBadcast, or go to our website at NotThatBadcast.com. And while you're there, make sure you check out our guest appearances page so you can find that guest appearance I did on the Movie Duel podcast, as well on a bunch of other different shows. I have so much fun talking movies and talking pretty much anything that I get a chance to talk about. So be sure to check out all of those guest appearance pages. Until next time, he's Peter, I'm Jay. This is It's Not That Bad, a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.